The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. On the phone line right now, actually in the studio in Bristol.
I'm sounding so good. This is above and beyond landline, man. This is locked in, straight plutonium.
Could you let me finish my intro?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. You're wrong. You could not be more wrong. No, go ahead.
America's sexiest sideline reporter, Rick Bucher.
You know what I've told people when they ask about the rotation for sideline reporters? I go, you know, I used to be the low man on the totem pole. Now I'm just the man on the totem pole.
That's true. It is a female dominated business. I enjoy when you do it because I know that there are the questions you ask, and then I'm trying to read in your mind the questions I know you want to ask, but you really can't because you're on live TV.
And not only live TV, but when we're doing a broadcast, this is not outside the lines. It's not SportsCenter. It's not pure journalism. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
There's a relationship.
True. And as I don't know if it's been announced yet, but ESPN is releasing a DVD of all of your exchanges with Greg Popovich. An hour-long DVD called Rick Bucher's Personal Hell.
There's no way it's an hour long. You'd be lucky to mine about quality 7 minutes out of those. Although, if you could get all of the conversation that happens before the interview actually happens, that would be pretty good. I said it on another... I said it someplace else that this last time, you know, he was his snarky self in the meeting before the game. Just so people know, it's not just with the sideline reporters. He can be snarky with pretty much anybody. And he was with the whole crew as we go in before games to talk to him. And so he was changing the lineup. He was putting Boris Diaw in the starting lineup. And the producer said, well, that's a pretty big thing. You know, why are you doing that? And he's like, it doesn't matter who starts. You know, you're like, this is a play. It's game one of the playoffs.
Right.
And you're changing your lineup. That's a pretty big deal. And he refused to answer it. So I said, just assure me that you're getting this out of your system now. So by the time you and I talk between the third and fourth quarter, that you're not going to be your usual glass eating self. And he kind of laughed. He said, no, you know, we'll be fine, da da da. And then he was so bad that we couldn't even air it.
Wow. You canceled it.
I literally, my first question was, you rested your guys, you know, down the stretch. What impact do you think it's had in your first playoff game? And I can tell now, you know, he gets this look on his face. He gets this uncomfortable look, like, he realizes that he's answering this on live, you know, live to tape TV, and so he says, well, you know, we just decided that's what we needed to do, and so he could have gone so many ways. He could have said, hey, you know what, it's why we had a rocky start. I think, you know, it took us a while to get our feet. He could have said, we're not going to be able to tell, you know, until we get deeper in the playoffs. He could have gone any number of ways. He just decided to be difficult. So the second one, I said, Tony Parker suggested at halftime that you guys needed to improve your rebounding. How do you – and before I could even finish the question, he goes, Tony Parker. And I go, yeah. He goes, our point guard. I go, yeah. Tony Parker, our point guard, is talking about – why is he talking about rebounding? I go, forget Tony Parker. Literally, this is going on. This is what's supposed to be like a 45-second interview.
Right.
I said, Tony – forget Tony Parker. How do you feel about how you're rebounding? He goes, that's a third question. And he starts walking back to the huddle.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
You might have to throw curveballs at him. Like, you might have to go, here with Greg Popovich. Greg, what was your favorite Don Nelson story?
If I...
Just like totally, like he won't know what to do. He'd have to answer it.
If I worked for Grantland and I was Bill Simmons, I might be able to get away with that. But I don't think Rick Bucher, as sideline reporter, has got the juice to survive that one when he just stare. Because if he walks away and we have no interview, then that comes back on me. So it's a great idea. And my last day on the job, it's what I plan to
definitely
do.
Definitely doing it. Yeah. I have a semi-serious question here because I've written about these between quarter interviews.
I take that back. I'm not even sure you could pull that off.
No, I wouldn't be able to pull that off. Yeah. What is the hit and miss ratio? Like, what's the best case scenario from a question you're going to ask a coach between quarters here?
The best case scenario is that he gives you a glimpse of the thinking behind a move that you may not have seen or that throws a curve. Like you ask the question because you think you know where he's going to go or what he's going to explain, and he goes a completely different direction. Now, the whole idea is what's tricky is that as the sideline reporter, you're supposed to play it dumb. Like I'm not supposed to know basketball. I'm just supposed to ask a question that's going to get him to explain something, even if I already think I know the answer. And so you try to leave it open and you try to hit a spot that's going to explain something that people have been watching in the game. The other part is if he gives you a little clue into where they're going in the fourth quarter, just something like, you know what, I'm sitting this guy until the 6.5 minute marker. It gives you some sense, like as you're watching, now you have something specific to look for because the coach said that they were going to do it.
Like during the Memphis Clipper game, which I'm not sure you were able to see, game three, did you see that game?
No, I saw maybe the end, I think.
Like this is why I can't be a sideline reporter, because I would ask Lionel Howell and Seti in the fourth quarter, Lionel, Rudy Gay is being guarded by Randy Foy and Nick Young.
Yeah.
Like, does he have any excuse whatsoever if he comes out of this game without having scored 40 points?
Yeah.
And then Lionel, oh, you know, we got to get Rudy some touches, but like, I almost don't know how you're able to refrain from asking a question like that. Because,
yeah.
It's like I watched an entire Clipper game just going crazy. I was like, really, Rudy? You Nick Young? Like, forget about the Randy Foy part. Right. Nick Young couldn't guard either of us.
I just wish.
And, yeah. Ugh.
See, I just wish we could pick out who we're going to interview. Like, because the coach has to do his thing. Let me just go to Rudy Gay and say, hey, Randy Foy and Nick Young, how come you can't get more done against them? Wouldn't you want to know the answer to that question?
Can't you shoot wherever, over them every time?
Wherever he takes it, wouldn't you love to know the answer to that question?
Like, I don't know if it was intentional by the Clippers or whether it's just a function of what their team is right now, but they went into game three saying, Rudy Gay, if he beats us, so be it.
Yeah.
But we're best off going small here. And hopefully he won't torch us. Now, I don't know if that's going to, you know, tonight maybe the light bulb will go off. We're taping this on Monday afternoon. Tonight maybe the light bulb will go off on Rudy. He did get to the free throw line that game, but he finished with 24, six of which came, you know, last second threes when they were way down and almost made a miraculous comeback. But, you know, we spent so much time focusing on Carmelo and Kobe all these high-profile guys, and yet, you know, the two guys that jumped out to me this weekend – one, Rudy Gay, because if he has a good game, they win game three.
Yeah.
And then two, Joe Johnson, who basically has the reverse situation of Paul Pierce in game two in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Where game four in Boston, all right, Joe Johnson, you have to play a great game today, and your team can go back to Atlanta tied 2-2. He scores 9 points, I think.
Yeah.
Or he took 9 shots or somewhere the number
so 9
was
invisible.
Above.
I couldn't tell.
Invisible.
I couldn't tell between the time that he was on the bench and he was on the floor. The only time I knew where he was is when they would show him on the bench. And I go, okay, there he is. And then I knew where he was. But as the game was going, if he was in it, I was not cognizant of the fact that he was on the floor, which is pretty wild. The most amazing thing to me about Rudy Gay, and it just gives you a glimpse into the separation between a Rudy Gay and even a Carmelo Anthony, but certainly a Kobe Bryant, is that he has vast talent. He has amazing talent. There's absolutely no thought into his game. There's no, this is how I'm going to attack this guy. This is where I'm going to exploit him. There's no science to his game whatsoever. And I feel it's why the Grizzlies, as dangerous as I thought they were going to the playoffs, why they're so vulnerable. Because between Rudy Gay and Mike Conley, who has proven to be a nice point guard, but he's not the kind of personality that can control Z-Bo and Rudy and like orchestrate that thing. And you really need that if you're going to be able to exploit all the talent that they have.
Yeah, you use the word control. I would even say harness.
Yes.
Just harness.
Yeah, harness
the troops.
He doesn't have to take them to another level. He just has to organize them. And I don't feel that they're really organized.
Well, I mispicked with that series because I thought they would win in six. That would be no contest. And that they still could. They still could, but the thing that jumped out, just you pick up so much stuff seeing it in person versus watching
on
TV.
For sure.
Tony Allen's at 45%. He's just not the same guy, and I don't know how bad.
Why do you think that is?
His knee's bothering him.
Okay.
You could see it. Have you done one of their playoff games?
No, yet? I have not. I haven't, just because of my schedule, and I'm either doing a game or then I'm on a plane or whatever. I've seen very little of those matchups. It's actually the difficulty in that, like, you know, seeing San Antonio, Utah, I could have told you after game one that was going to be a sweep because Utah, you know, just being in their huddles, like it was we're just happy to be here and we hope we don't get blown out type of atmosphere.
I was disappointed in that. I actually thought that because of the size that they had and how vulnerable San Antonio is to teams that play above the rim like that. I thought, they're going to give them a series. They'll give them a nice game three at home.
But who's the leader on that team?
Happy to be there.
Who's the leader on that team?
They don't have one. It's
probably Al Jefferson who was just quoted as saying after game three, nobody can beat that team.
Right.
You're not even out of the series yet.
Yeah.
And
come on,
you're already
now.
Gone. You know what? No, nobody can beat them. They're really good.
Yeah. Well,
that's your leader.
And Memphis, same thing. You know, they blow that. Everyone focused on the Clippers in that unbelievable game one comeback. But
if
you have one guy on your team who just looks around and goes, hey, guys, this is ridiculous. I'm like, let me just hit a three here and just stop this and let's go home.
You know, in a lot
of
ways.
They don't have that guy.
Yeah. I mean, look, Chicago's the same, in the exact same boat. They're still dialed in. It's still amazing that they can't score to save their lives. And yet they've made those games competitive. They've held what should be an up and down Philadelphia team just by sort of will, grit, and sticking to the system. They've made those games competitive. But you look at them and you just go, you know, at some point you're going to need a bucket and you're going to Carlos Boozer on a dribble drive from the left elbow. Good luck with that. One blocked and one kicked out of bounds. That's about what – were you expecting anything different? But the flip side is – what else would you possibly go to?
Well, and this is why, you know, that it's almost gone too far with, you know, especially I think Carmelo has become the focal point of this about how you closers are overrated, crunch time stats, Kobe stinks in crunch
it's
time.
Hero ball.
Stuff.
It's hero,
hero ball.
It's hero ball. Trying to win the game is actually a bad thing.
And here's the thing. It's not about the stats and it's not about this guy can score in this spot. It's about the confidence.
Right.
You need to have one guy in your team that just kind of knows where he is, what he's doing, what he's capable of at all times. And if you don't have that guy, it can fall apart in 2 minutes.
Well, it's not only that, but it's that everybody else can react off
that
of
guy.
What that guy does because you know where he's going to try to get to. In fact, you've seen it enough times that you know if he's going to miss, the ball's probably going to come off this way or in this direction, and it gives you – a second chance, or it gives you a chance to prevent the run out if it's not a absolute last second. And to me, that's why, to segue deftly to the Miami Heat, it's why it makes all the sense in the world that they at the beginning of the year said, Dwayne Wade's going to be the closer. We're going to play pick and roll with Chris Bosh at the end on last possessions, and we're going to just try to dial that in. Look, you could argue that at the beginning of the year they should have said, no, we're going to make LeBron James that guy and we're going to do it through him. Okay, but they made that. If you're going to argue that, you needed to do it at the beginning of the year because you're not changing it up now. And you know what? They will succeed or fail. And even doing what they did against the Knicks, I don't consider that a failure because it was one more experience in trying to do it that way. And as long as it's not a situation where it knocks them out of the playoffs, then it ends up being a learning experience and it adds to the puzzle. I don't have a problem with what they tried, because now Dwayne Wade the next time can look at it and say, okay, next time I'm going to do this, and if I get this result, I'm going to do this instead.
And it's why, you know, you watched Denver last night against the Lakers. Very winnable game.
Yep.
Very winnable. Mm-hmm. And just the last 3 minutes.
Yeah, what are they going to
be? Yeah. Where are we going? And Indiana and Denver, very similar teams, I feel like. Like one of those bullpen by committee type teams. But
Philadelphia.
But at least with Indiana, Danny Granger, who I don't think is even that good, at least he'll take the shots.
Yes.
And at least they can go to David West. They have two guys who at least will say, guys, I'll shoot here. Get out of my way. I'll do something.
Yeah, I think David West is that guy that I probably lean on the most. It's a little difficult. It's always difficult when the guy that you want to do it can't catch the ball out near midcourt and start the play. Anytime you need to send it to, you know, give it to a guy below the top of the key, there's a way to trap it to make sure that that guy's not going to get the ball. But that said, David West is the guy that I feel most comfortable with in that situation. I'm really interested to see. I don't think the Pacers can beat Miami. I just want to see whether they can take something out of them, whether they can rattle them. And I don't really have an answer. I would not be surprised if that series went six games, and I wouldn't be surprised if Miami swept them.
It does feel like it could be one of those best player on the floor series where every game Miami's going to have the best guy on the floor, whether it's LeBron or Dwayne, and then it's over in five.
Dictates the result. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But one last thing about this whole confidence point, like, you know, you could have picked apart Paul Pierce's game two in Atlanta. He's 12 for 26. Mm-hmm. Now he didn't even shoot 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Eight turnovers, a lot of turnovers. But man, you know, there's something to be said for you're going into that game. You're Paul Pierce. You know that unless you have an awesome game, your team is going to lose. And that's it. You have to have an awesome game.
Yep.
And everything they did ran through him.
Yep.
Avery Bradley's, you know, in his second playoff game ever, or mm-hmm. his second playoff game where he's actually playing. No Rondo. Mm-hmm. KG's got the hip flexor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought what Pierce did in that game was one of the six or seven best games of his career. I tweeted that, and then people, oh, eight turnovers. It's like, come on. Hey, watch basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. Like, to go into that game knowing what you need to do and then do it, and then you look at what Joe Johnson did yesterday, very similar situation, he's just invisible. And that's the difference between those two guys. You trust Paul Pierce, you don't trust Joe Johnson.
Yeah, no, I'll not take this as an opportunity to jump on LeBron James, but I'm going to take LeBron to task a little bit. The game against the Knicks, game four against the Knicks was a place where that's a game where you put your foot on their throat.
Yes.
And LeBron didn't. Like, you look, and this is where I have the problem, is that after the game, people will look at his numbers and say, oh, hey, you know, it wasn't his fault. You know, he had a pretty good game. He's always, I mean, it's a reflection of his talent. He's always going to have great numbers. Chris Webber always had great numbers. Guys who can do a variety of things are always going to fill that box score, and it's going to look good. But if you take it in the context of watching the game, then you have it changes the entire dynamic. Take it into context, he's the MVP of the league, and you're trying to win a championship. And how do you get there? You knock the Knicks out as quickly as possible, and you get rest for Chris Bosh's hamstring and for Dwayne Wade and yourself, and you make sure that you are maximizing your ability to win that ring. And that's where I just feel LeBron's attention wanders at times, or he doesn't seize the moment. And people say, well, why does he have to do that? Because you're talking about him as the best player in the league and in the pantheon of the greatest players. And all of them did that. They didn't have to be coaxed into it. They didn't have to be criticized into it. They didn't have to be chastised so that they would do it. They did it in and of themselves. And I still, even now, whether it's posting up or whether it's taking shots in the fourth quarter, I feel like LeBron is doing it in response to the criticism as opposed to I'm doing it because I know that this is the way I'm going to win a championship.
Hey, and to follow that point, I'm not quite as disappointed as you were in his game four. I do think that was a classic step on the throat game. They didn't do it. Here's what I took away from that game. You're LeBron James. Like, just think of it like if he's wired like Michael Jordan is. You're right. Going into that game. You have Carmelo Anthony, who is probably your greatest rival other than Durant at your position.
Right.
There are two guys at your position that you have to really worry about from a big picture standpoint, him and Durant.
Right.
You have a chance here in this game to basically rip Carmelo's heart out, and now he goes into the summer. You're extinguishing him. He goes in the summer now with everybody in New York going, we can't win with this guy. This guy's a loser. This guy's ruined our team.
Not only that, but we were crazy to ever put him in the category of LeBron, being anywhere close to LeBron James.
And this is somebody you grew up with. You've been playing against since you were like, what, 14?
Yep.
You're in the same draft together. He wins the college championship.
Yep.
This is a guy that you can now eliminate from the conversation.
Right.
And instead he has 41 and Shane Batty is guarding him half the time.
Right.
I just feel like Jordan goes into that game, and maybe it's not fair to compare anyone to Jordan because he's the best ever, but Jordan goes into that game and asks the coach, I want to guard Carmelo this game.
He didn't ask.
I have a chance to put Carmelo's entire career in a sleeper hold.
He doesn't ask. He goes,
right.
I got Melo this game. And
tell Shane Batty to stay the F away.
Yeah.
I have Carmelo.
On this possession, you know, I mean, throughout that game, I would even say, you know, again, they decided they were going to go a certain way. But if I'm LeBron James at the beginning of the year when the discussion is held, okay, we're going to go with Wade and Bosch, you know, last possessions. Whenever that was decided, the first time, whether I was in on the conversation or the first time it was happened, I come away from that saying, that's not happening again. I'm getting the ball at the end of the game. There's no other way we're doing this. Either that or you trade me right now. Because I'm not going down. I'm the best player in the game. I'm not riding on somebody else getting the job done when the game is on the line. And that is not in LeBron's DNA. And I don't, like, people think that I'm bashing him for that. I'm not, because I look, there's so much that I like about him, and he is a huge talent. I look at the scope of who he is and what he's accomplished, and there's plenty of things to admire. But don't ask me to pretend that he's someone or something that he's not. And that's not a bad thing to acknowledge that. It's almost, in some ways, it's just being fair to everyone, including him, to not suggest that he's something that he's not.
Well, you're comparing him to a much higher standard, which I think is totally fair because he's the most talented basketball player in the league.
He's a three-time MVP.
He's a three-time MVP, which puts him in a conversation with seven other guys historically, and that's it. He is, in person, the best player you could see in the league.
Yep.
I think he can do the most things of anybody probably since Jordan and Akeem.
He has crazy gifts.
Yeah.
Crazy gifts.
We're judging him by a higher standard, and that doesn't mean you're hating on him. You're just saying, hey, look, this is a guy who I've written before. He was handed the deluxe car wash package.
Yeah.
Yeah, every check mark was checked off.
Yeah.
And if, you know, here are the Celtics, who, and Wojnarowski wrote about this on Yahoo today.
Who?
The Celtics, Wojnarowski.
I'm just kidding.
Well, he wrote a Rondo column today that, you know, I thought he tapped into a couple key points, which was, you know, mainly the Celtics feel like if Rondo doesn't hurt his elbow, they could have taken that Miami team last year.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't necessarily agree with them, but they really deeply feel like this is a mulligan now for last year, which I don't think a lot of people appreciate. People feel like, oh, yeah, they would have lost them. I don't know what would have happened, but I know that Rondo dislocated his elbow at a crucial point in game three.
I agree. And I think that I would say that this is a better Celtics team this year than last year's team.
And a more resilient team. And I think, you know, the Bradley part, Brandon Bass versus Big Baby, who was a Section 8 by playoffs last year. So they basically added two guys to the mix. KG's playing better than he was last year.
I have to say, I was so disappointed. I was a big Big Baby believer. And Brandon Bass is good, but he's not like Glenn Davis actually understands the game at a much better, higher level than Brandon Bass does. And maybe that's part of his problem. But what Bass gives them just by being that guy who has that locked in mid-range jumper. Now when they play pick and roll with Paul and Rondo, which I believe is the only team in the league that plays a 1-3 or 3-1 pick and roll. And now you have Ray Allen, KG, and Brandon Bass, all of whom can hit a mid-range jumper if you figure out how to stop that weird 1-3 pick and roll. You know, I didn't have the confidence that Glenn was going to do something crazy. Glenn was going to like put the ball on the floor and try to drive or whatever. Brandon Bass, he stays in his lane. That's the best thing you can say about him. But you know what? This team, it's exactly what they need from that spot.
That shot is open all the time, and Big Baby occasionally hit it. And then from February on, after Perkins straight last year, missed it all the time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons they didn't, you know, it was hard to take them seriously last
year. On the
Bass
flip side,
makes
you're
it
shocked.
Constantly.
You're shocked if Brandon misses that shot.
Yeah, he makes it. That's a shot. That's the reason he's in the league, and that's the reason he makes $4.5 million a year or whatever he makes.
Not quite Bill Simmons money.
No, my range is now 17 feet.
No, I'm not talking about your jump shooting range. I'm talking about your salary.
Oh, no, I'm talking about my jump shooting.
Yeah, I'm talking about your salary.
I don't know if you got the memo, but I'm not a 3-point shooter anymore. I've had to reconstruct my game.
I didn't get the first memo that you were. I don't have to change my playbook on you.
I now have an early 1970s Walt Frazier-esque 17 to 18 foot jumper, and that's what I go for. I don't even
now,
shoot 3-pointers. I don't even look at the line.
Wasn't it just now? Are you talking about college 3 or pro?
I don't even look at the 3-point line anymore. It's just that's my game.
Oh, you go right by it.
18 footers. Yeah, I don't even look at it. Yeah.
Weren't you the one just bragging about you couldn't wait for me to come down and play pickup with you in L.A. because your game was
There was no bragging. There was no bragging. I said I was excited to have you join us.
No, that is so wrong. You were talking about your game being locked in.
It's locked in from the standpoint that I'm 42 and every once in a while I can play well.
Well, I think that was my response.
Yeah. I will say, though, it has given me – I've been playing twice a week, and it does give you a whole different respect for, you know, when these guys get older, you know, somebody like Nash, who's 3 years younger than I am.
Yeah.
The fact that he made it through that schedule.
Oh, no, it's
incredible.
And
granted, he's one of the great world-class athletes, but just
– No, still.
Your body changes when you get older. Like, I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're a world-class athlete or Joe Schmo. Your body changes. Him to just get through that is amazing.
Not only your body changes, but people don't appreciate, like, the speed and the physical beatdown that these guys take in playing an NBA game and then playing another one the next night and the next night. I mean, you don't put it in the context of, yeah, I play, you know, I used to play pickup every day and da 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 da. The strain on the body and the beatdown, and the other thing, if you roll your ankle, you know what? You don't get to take the next 3 days off of playing pickup. You still need to go out there and go at the same pace and figure out a way, which now causes all kinds of other problems. Now, I'm with you 100%. And I actually, when we were in, the hotel in Denver, has a racquetball court that they converted into, they basically put a hoop in there. And I have not stayed at that place in the longest time. And I went there and I probably have not shot in like 6 to 8 months. And I just went in there and I was afraid to find out what it was, what my game and my shot looked like. And I have to tell you, I was in there by myself just shooting around for like 30, 40 minutes. And I just loved it. It made me realize how much I miss just playing and going into a gym and shooting for an hour and like just in that rhythm of getting shots up and fine tuning things and working on your right-handed spin hook. And I just, it was like, God, I wish I could do this every day.
Yeah, I know I'm going to get hurt at some point soon, so I've been enjoying the ride the last few
months. All I'm trying to do is I'm trying to stretch to avoid the Achilles. Because every guy I've known, when they go out and they go, it's like you get kicked by a donkey in the heel and suddenly you can't run and you're basically done after that. It's
the old
going
guy
to the
injuries
pool.
Are, yeah, they're calf injuries, Achilles, all that stuff. And there's just no way to avoid it no matter how much you stretch.
We're sounding really old right now.
You know, the other thing I was reading about Kobe last week, I've made a bunch of jokes about the Germany and the trip and I, you know, just it's comedic fodder.
Right.
But at the same time, this almost feels like it should be a bigger story. He is saying that his knees were bone on bone last year, which is that's it. You're done when it's bone on bone. And now he is running around like he did 3 years ago. And it's making me think, like, now does Brandon Roy go to Germany?
Yeah.
Like Brandon Roy's only what, 26?
Well, you know
he
what?
He couldn't come back and do the same Germany thing?
I talked to somebody who looked into it. And by the way, they now supposedly there's a guy in New York who does this thing, this platelet enriching deal.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other guys who are looking into it or looking to get it done. I want to say A-Rod was one of the guys.
A-Rod did. He did. He went to Germany.
Yeah. But what I'm told is that it doesn't regenerate or rejuvenate the knee. It just makes you feel better for a period of time. And then when it wears off, you're actually in worse – you're almost masking what's actually going on in your knee. So the question is, like, how long can Kobe get away from this? And for all I know, he's, like, hired – you know, he's hired the guy's assistant and has built this guy's platelet-enriching thing and is doing it, like, every week just to find his way. I mean, Kobe, I believe, would pretty much sacrifice anything to get two more rings.
Totally.
And
also to get to 40,000.
Exactly.
Don't forget the 40,000.
Yeah, no. I hadn't thought about it, but that's definitely there. I really wonder what his body is going to be like once, because he's not going to quit until it just absolutely falls apart.
Well, you know what's really funny? He's going to be driving himself toward the scoring record. And it's going to be like one of those triathlons where the person's crawling to the finish line and then somebody totally fresh runs by them. LeBron or Durant.
Yeah.
I forget. I think Durant's already at 10,000. But if Durant stays healthy, it's going to be pretty hard for him not to get to 40,000.
Yeah,
Especially because he could shoot threes and, you know, he could totally change his career when he's about 35. We have to talk about that quickly. James Harden went to a place on Saturday that I was not fully prepared for.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of recalibrating this whole Oklahoma City thing. We only have 5 minutes left, then you have to go. I thought they had what Mike Lombardi likes to call the look in that game four, where it was like, yeah, they could have rolled over. Dallas could have won their one game. Then they could have finished Dallas off in game five. And instead, they're like, no, James, we're going to clear out. You rip out Dallas's heart, and then Kevin will finish, and we're going to go home.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did. Did that change how you feel about them heading into these next couple rounds?
No, because I picked them at the beginning of the year to win it all. And while that was a edgy pick at the time, and I didn't know everything I know about them now, and I didn't see moments like the one you just described, that's where I was headed. So that only gives me a little more confidence that they're capable of actually pulling it off. My only question is, I believe that the next step now is for them to have that look and to do that against the Lakers, which I saw them do at times during the regular season. So I know they're capable of that. The big question is, can they do it against San Antonio? Because San Antonio just has so many guys who won't blink. There's a couple guys in Dallas and there's a couple guys in LA that you need to overcome. And then the rest of the guys will fall. San Antonio just has more of those guys than anybody else. And that's going to be the real test for them, is whether they can do it against San Antonio. Because as I recall, I have not seen them do that. They have not demonstrated that they can do that against San Antonio.
And, you know, there's a really interesting subplot with this whole thing. Oklahoma City was basically created to mirror San Antonio.
Yeah, no.
Presti was fetching sodas for RC Buford once upon a time.
He was actually he was eating all their energy bars when he was like an unpaid intern there, and they finally the equipment manager finally went, "Hey Sam, I need some of these for the players. Because he was like rating. He was making right. no money.
And everything about this team was built to basically resemble the Spurs. Yep. And, you know, I felt like I thought there were two series that were kind of destined to happen in this playoffs, potentially. One was Oklahoma City's San Antonio. The other was Celtics Bulls, just because of the 2009, 2012. Yeah. Now we're the old guys. You know, once upon a time, you were the young Bucks. Yep. Now you're the fit. But that got screwed up. So this is like our one last destined series. The other one, I guess you could say, you know, potentially a destiny series is Spurs Lakers in the conference finals, just because has there ever been teams that have had played more times, but yet there was the Fisher shot? I don't feel like this was the rivalry it should have been. Does that make sense?
No, but I would say the same for like the one that I think is the apocryphal meeting is San Antonio Boston in the final. KG and Tim Duncan going at it one last time. And I know, you know, KG will never catch Tim as far as rings is concerned, but can I get the last word in? Would it be a total flip from where this thing started with Duncan dominating KG? Does KG get the last word? And quite honestly, just the last, you know, the last great run of the original big threes deciding who gets to walk away. I was just in with our boss talking about this, and you know, people probably wouldn't get great ratings. Everyone's terrified of San Antonio getting there because they just don't draw. But to me, that in its way is as good and maybe better than an Oklahoma City Miami Heat final, because let's take one last look at the old guard. I think we're going to have plenty of time still to see Kevin Durant and LeBron James go at it. But give me one more Tim Duncan KG for all the marbles. I thoroughly enjoy that.
Plus San Antonio Boston, it's possible 7 Hall of Famers in that series.
Oh, I mean
jumping the gun on Rondo obviously, but
well,
I think the other 6 make it.
You got 2 great coaches. You have great execution. You have I think there would be storylines galore for people who love basketball. I don't know if the mainstream would jump in on it, but basketball fans, I think that they would relish that matchup.
Well, the seas have kind of parted for the Celts because you know, they're getting this Bulls Sixers winner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, they should be able to.
It's a totally different animal.
They should be able to dispatch that and then be rested. And again, that's where I want to see what Indiana can do against Miami. Whether Miami, I mean, look, let's face it. Miami is the one team so far that has not, you know, knock on wood for them, has not suffered that debilitating injury.
Had a big one. Yeah.
They I think of all of the teams can least afford it.
And the last thing I'm saying, then I'll let you go. The more I look at Chris Paul and the more I watch him, and, you know, I probably have seen too many Clipper games. I pick them apart, bad free throw shooting, shaky coach. You know, they can't match up certain ways. But if it's tied in the last 3 minutes, Chris is winning the game.
Yeah.
And there's only a couple guys in the league you can say that about, and that's why if I'm the Spurs, I'm at least a little frightened of the. I'd rather play the Grizzlies than the Clippers, put it that way.
I guess. I don't know. I would think that the Grizzlies coming up against San Antonio, because what they did to them last year.
It's not the same team though. Zebo's not the same. Tony Allen's not the same.
Understood. But I don't think the Clippers go in against San Antonio feeling like any level of confidence. By and large. Maybe Chris Paul does. But
I'm amazed by Chris.
Well, you know what? Let's see it, because to me, as much as I was pushing Tony Parker to be on the MVP ballot, and I think he deserves it. I think he's decidedly taken a step up, but he is French, and I need to see him carry it all the way through. And as good as he's been, I want to see him against Chris Paul. If he wins that matchup, which he has during the regular season, decidedly, then I'm willing to say, okay, he's the leader of this team. But if he doesn't, If Chris Paul gets the better of him, then I got to go back to saying, ah, wee wee.
Yeah, he's been a polarizing guy for you. Rick, go do SportsCenter. Thanks for your time.
On my way.
You
got it.
Later in the playoffs. All right, take care.
Bye.
All right, let's go to a crappy cell phone in the New York City area from Grantland.com, Atlanta's own Rembert Brown. He's very mad at Joe Johnson. Hey, you're very mad at Joe Johnson. I thought I'd give you some time to vent.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm not too thrilled. I'm less thrilled than I usually am with him, which is sort of saying something after last night.
You told me a few weeks ago that you had a theory that Joe Johnson has murdered professional basketball in Atlanta. And the only other Atlanta Hawks fan I know, John Dahl, who one of our 30 for 30 producers disagreed, said that Joe saved pro basketball in Atlanta. So kind of expound on that whole theory.
Well, first off, I think the verb you're using changes every time. I think it's getting more and more severe. I think it started with hurt and now it's at murdered. But
that's what I do.
I definitely have to disagree that he saved it. I think people were excited because we had our first, 20 plus point game score coming to Atlanta in a while. So people were excited about that. But, when I think of a player saving professional sports in Atlanta, it's in my lifetime, it's pretty much been Vic and only Vic. And because people loved Vic and Vic for a time, and they seem to love us back. But I don't think there's, and we're very needy people. Like, we need to feel like we're being loved to love back. And Joe has never really been that for us, like, as a personality. So, I don't think Joe has done much to save Atlanta basketball. And because of the whole contract and everything, which I think every Atlanta fan was pretty confused about, when that didn't really result in much than a first round exit in the playoffs for a couple of years. I definitely don't think there's much good blood between the Atlanta fan base and Joe Johnson. But maybe I'm projecting, but I don't think I am.
Buker and I talked about it before you came on. I was saying that the biggest difference between Paul Pierce and Joe Johnson, game two, Paul Pierce knows that the Celtics are going to lose unless he has a great game. Game three and game four, Joe Johnson, a little bit of a similar situation. No Josh Smith, especially yesterday. Like, all right, now's the time where I got to step up and just destroy Boston and tie this series. And instead he went the other way, and you barely remembered he was on the floor for four quarters.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is, and I, in the little shoot around that we did today, one of the reasons I brought up sort of how many shots sort of the big players on the other playoff teams shot, and not talking about how much they scored, but how much they shot, LeBron, Wade, even a Granger, and then a Pierce, like they're shooting, at least like 18, 20 shots a game. And a lot of them are going in, but even if Joe, even if he didn't score 35, but at least he's putting up shots. At least I sort of feel like he's a part of the fabric of the game. But when he puts up eight shots and makes four of them, and then like that's his whole stat line, I can't help but feel like he's just completely tuned out of the game. And I can't be convinced that he cares as much as a Pierce.
Josh Smith, game five is, I think, what is it? Is it Tuesday night? Yeah.
Tuesday night.
So, if the Celtics win that game, or if they finish the series in six or whatever, if the Hawks get bounced, that probably is going to be it for Josh Smith, because I think he goes into his last year of his contract, not totally happy in Atlanta, kind of sniffed around for a trade in February, and, had a great season. I voted for him for second team All-NBA, somebody they could get a pretty big haul from, I think, if they wanted to trade him and kind of rebuild a little bit. Do you think they would trade him?
I think they will, which I think is sort of a shame, because I don't think that he's the problem. Like I remember when Josh used to get a lot of the flack that now Joe gets. I remember when he sort of filled a role that Marvin has now, where like every time he puts up the ball, everyone's just immediately worried that like knows that it's not going to go in. When Josh, like his first two or three seasons. Like, he could not catch a break from the Atlanta fans, but because he's improved so much and at least seems to care and be invested, like, I feel, you know, him and Horford has sort of been the Hawks that the fans seem to get behind ever since, you know, and Jamal Crawford was like that too, but then we got rid of him. But, so as a fan, it's going to be unfortunate they do trade him, because I was actually really starting to like him and thought he was improving and putting up good numbers, but I don't see us keeping him, or at least I don't see them keeping him, you know?
Yeah, I don't see it either. I think it's interesting that you said Vic was the only one that the Atlanta fans loved the most. Like, the Braves had that awesome run there in the 90s, ending up winning a World Series. Like, there was no Brave that resonated?
No, I take that back. I take that back, because I've for better or for worse, I lump the Hawks and the Falcons together, and the Braves sort of occupy a different space in my fan mind. Because I mean, the Braves I've always liked the Braves. I've never wavered as a Braves fan, you know, partly because as I was growing up, the Braves were always good. So I've never had that sort of fluctuating, I hate y'all, I love y'all type of thing. So yeah, I mean, the 90s Braves, the pitchers, Chipper's always been there, you know, other people like that. Like, those, I can't say that one, I don't think there's, because you sort of lumped all the pitchers together as sort of one entity, not one of them. Maddox wasn't, you know, just like exponentially more famous or important than a Glavine or a Smoltz. And those have sort of been the three main. And, you know, Chipper's always been, you know, a big Atlanta guy, but it never, like, in the stratosphere like a Vic was, even though it was just for a couple years with Vic. But, yeah, I will take that back slightly. But still, I think of sports, I think of Atlanta in terms of, like, the city rounding, like, getting behind one dude. It'll always be Vic. It'll always be Vic.
I think you should stand by your initial point. I don't think a Brave, as you said, it was more of the pitchers than anything. And there was also, like, in a weird way, those teams were kind of disappointing. That they dominated for, what was it, like 12 years? They won one World Series, and it was like the one World Series that you didn't want to win. You know, the 95 one. It was the worst one. It was like everybody hated baseball. It was still 2 years before the Maguire-Sosa thing, or 3 years, and people were mad about the strike. Like, that was kind of like the lost World Series for me. I'm not even sure I watched it. No offense. I don't really remember what happened. I don't even know who you played.
Yeah, I mean, I think Albert Bell was on that other team. You know,
oh, the Indians, that's right.
Yeah.
No, I remember. They beat the Red Sox.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I won't go as far as saying those teams are disappointed, just because it was fun to have a team that you knew was good. And then, I mean, they were excited. That was a fun team. Like, that, that was a great time to be a sports fan in the city. The one weird thing about the Braves, though, is that they're sort of the baseball team for the whole South, in a way. Like, unlike, you know, basketball, where, you know, every mid-major city has a team, the Braves sort of, I mean, they're still Atlanta's team, but sort of everyone in the region rounds comes around them. So, you know, I'm not saying that takes away from their Atlanta-ness at all, but, you know, my relationship with them will always be a little different, for better and for worse, because my highs with the Falcons and Hawks are really high, and my lows with the Falcons and Hawks are extremely, extremely low. Like, last night was horrible. That was one of the worst 2 hours of basketball watching I've ever had to sit. It was bad.
So Dominique doesn't really, he never was in the stratosphere?
I mean, Dominique has always been in the stratosphere, in the sense that my family, I have a very long-time Atlanta family, they still talk about Dominique as, like, the golden years of the Hawks.
Yeah.
Because that was, you know, I mean, he was, you know, Jordan Foyle for a while, and, you know, that was the mid-late 80s, but, I mean, that wasn't when I was watching sports. You know, I started really watching basketball as Dominique was starting to decline in importance, but he's always, you know, he's still, like, Hank Aaron-ish figure in Atlanta, in the sense that he just, you know, is still always around, and, you know, his presence is still very much felt in the city. But he, you know, I think he's a weird figure because Dominique was great, but, you know, he sort of gets lost in that era of really, really good 80s basketball players because he's an interesting character. But he's still, like, obviously the number one hawk, but no offense, that's not, you know, saying a ton.
He's probably, no. It was a little bit Tommy Hearns-ish. His career.
Yeah, like exactly.
His most famous games came because other guys that were in the game did something better than him.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no one, I mean, it's not anything completely against his career or anything, but that's not the best way to be known, you know, to be known for that and some dunk contests. But.
Last question. You know, you're in New York. Girls.
Yeah.
Girls is a hot show right now in New York City, a little polarizing. People like it or they hate it, one or the other. Where do you stand on Girls?
On Girls, I love the show. I'm a huge fan. I feel like I've had more conversations about this than any show in recent memory.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, reading all, especially after that first and that second episode, I think it's becoming sort of the cool thing to now get behind it. But after the first two episodes where it was just criticism after criticism after criticism, I think that people are starting to realize that it is a pretty good representation of a specific type of or a specific demographic that exists in New York City or within the 20-something female population. And I think at first people had more of a problem with that type of girl and less of a problem with the actual show, but they didn't have anyone to blame, so they just blamed sort of Lena Dunham and the girls in the show and whatnot. But I've been a fan from the beginning, and I think it's gonna keep doing well. I haven't seen the fourth episode yet. I'm probably gonna do that today, but from what I heard from last night, I was just so depressed after the Hawks game, I just went to sleep. But after. I heard it was even better than the third episode, so I'm excited.
It's a great show, and I tweeted my support after the first episode. It's so hard to create a pilot episode where you feel like you know like five of the characters after 30 minutes, which she did, and it felt like she was. It's almost like a little bit like LeBron. It felt like the show was being judged to some impossible higher standard, and the things that people were doing to nitpick with it was just crazy to me. Like, nobody ever watched Entourage in the first season and said, oh, these people, they're morally corrupt. All they care about is like having sex and partying. Like, nobody ever said that about it. And then she creates these girls and it's like, oh, these people, oh, they're anti-heroes. It's like, that's the whole point. They're not, they're these flawed characters.
I'm really into it also because I'm just really impressed that Lena Dunham, like real life Lena Dunham is, you know, she's 25 and she did this. I just think I'm impressed and sort of in awe of the fact that she has sort of created something like this. I'm a big fan. I think the Entourage example is pretty funny because people took it easier because they didn't expect it to really be anything mind blowing. And so they just let them say and do whatever they wanted. But with something that, you know, had the potential of being great, it got put under just a much more intense microscope. So I don't know. I am very pleased and I'm glad other people are starting to become equally pleased.
Yeah, and you know what else? When somebody's in their mid-20s and that talented, the answer isn't to just start picking them apart and make them feel bad about themselves, you know? Like, not a lot of Lena Dunham sitting around.
Who does she think she is? Like, being 25 and wanting to write something great, you know? I almost feel like I have to get behind her because, I mean, like, that's something that I want to do. Like, I think that's the I totally support her if she's listening, you know?
She's definitely not listening, but the BS Report supports girls.
She's listening to the BS Report.
That's a great show. I actually was thinking like a great sub show would be just a camera on my wife's facial expressions during the show. My wife hasn't liked a show this much in like probably since when Sex and the City was good. which they get compared, but it's totally different shows. But she's just so into it, and she makes the same faces that I would make during a Celtics game, like a game seven.
Yeah.
Just like smiling and then looking intense and all that stuff. But it's really good, and I hope she keeps it up and that none of the nitpicking gets to her. Rembert Brown, keep plugging away. I have by the way, anybody who listens to the BS Report but doesn't check Grantland all the time should check out the two blogs, because Rembert has been doing double duty for a while, including one of my favorite segments, which is called Rem Explains the 80s. What was your favorite one that you've done so far?
Favorite one? I think probably my favorite one, and I think, you know, this was just like a special week where I sort of had a lot more free time than normally. The one that I did about Double Dare, I think was probably one of my favorites, because I just decided to do the entire episode instead of like a segment of it. And it was it was so aggressively long, but I really loved it and people really liked it. So I like it when it's either a TV show or a music video. And I think those are the ones that go over the best. And I think that was my favorite TV show and music video. I think Lionel Richie, I think that was the Hello video for Lionel Richie. That was probably just the most fun I've had writing one. Like, I was just like laughing and smiling like while I was at my laptop the entire time. And, you know, I think the skit is funny because it sort of started off as a joke that you had. You're like, hey, it'd be funny if Rembert did this. And I thought it was just going to be a one-time thing. But now it's like the one thing I have in my schedule every single week, except for that in the trailers. So I don't know. Well, I'm a fan.
What's amazed me about working with people like you and Maze, because I always assume everybody I hang out with is within about 8 to 10 years of my age range. And like, I was amazed that you had never even seen Truly by Lionel Richie. Like, I think it was the first time you'd seen it, right?
I just never seen it. I knew the song, and right. I just, you know, there's just some music videos that I just missed, you know? It wasn't like I never heard of the person or anything. It's just I never saw the video, and I was
But it made sense to me, though, because it's like, yeah, of course he's never seen it. He's 17 years younger than me, or however many years younger you are. Like, why would he have seen this? But, like, when I was in high school, or whenever that video came out, and we would spend, you know, we would just be breaking it down. Like, why did he have to, like, lie about how bad the sculpture was? Like, this is what I see when I see you. And it's like, that's not me. That's Patrick Ewing. But it's really a tour de force. It definitely doesn't look like Lionel Richie. We can all agree on that. But I have one for you that is either going to be this week or next week that I've been sitting on for a while that I'm pretty excited about.
That's good. That's good. It's hilarious because LaSanti seems to have, he must have like a list of 40 just like in an Excel file or something, because whenever I remind him on Wednesday, he emails me back in about 5 seconds. So he's like rummaging through the internet. I think he's plotted it out through July or August at this point.
I am a little wounded. LaSanti took over as our pop culture editor. He doesn't even consult me with Rembert Explains the 80s. He's just taking it over. He's hijacked it from me.
I don't think he wants
he doesn't want to share it. I think we should at least get joint custody.
No, he wants it, man.
Yeah, I love the I finally came barging in and made you watch the outfield, the Your Love video. Was the guy blind, the pian? Did we ever figure out the guy in the synthesizer? Was he blind? Was he not blind?
Someone emailed me after. I love getting emails. I get more emails about those than anything else. And because everyone has an opinion. And I got two emails from two different people saying that he wasn't blind. It was just like a style decision. But he was behaving blind, and he was giving like very Stevie-esque blind piano playing mannerisms the entire time, but apparently he wasn't blind. So
that's bad karma, and that explains what happened to the outfield. You can make fun of Stevie.
I mean, the fact that you picked that song also is hilarious because it's like one of the, it's like a Journey Don't Stop Believing as yeah. like fratty song that I heard thousands and thousands of times in college. You know, like wow. I couldn't pick a person in the outfield out of the lineup before seeing that video, but I had heard that song like just literally thousands of times is just an understatement. It's unbelievable.
Well, when we get to the 1 year anniversary of Rem Explains the 80s, I think we have to do, it's almost like too much of a cliched pick, which is why we haven't done it yet, but Journey's Separate Ways, which was the iconic, cheesy, unintentional yeah. comedy video of the 80s. Again, too cliched of a pick, but I think on the 1 year anniversary, maybe we have to do that one.
Maybe we'll do that. I have one last question, because you know I'm going to the game on Tuesday in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah, you're going to Atlanta. Yeah.
Yeah. Any playoff basketball game? I've never been to a playoff basketball game. I guess that's not that surprising. But I've been like, ever since you suggested that I go, I've just been like thinking about just. I didn't expect it to be 3-1 Celtics. I'll be completely honest. I thought it might have been 2-2. But I am. I can't figure out what type of Atlanta fan is going to show up for this game. It might be a half-empty Phelps Arena, to be completely honest.
Well, that's the thing. The playoffs can go one of two ways. Either it can bring the best out of a fan base, or it can just be like, you know, some terrible holiday where your uncle gets drunk and just awful things happen and everybody's just scarred emotionally. And I think that's where this might, Game 5 might go for you.
Yeah, I was talking to a few friends that I told I was coming to Atlanta, and they're like, sort of in the mindset that I unfortunately am, where they were like, I just want this to be over.
Yeah,
you know, it's like
those are the worst.
After the game yesterday, I almost had the thought of like, it would almost be better if we didn't have a team, because at least we wouldn't get embarrassed on national television. It was so bad yesterday. Like, I don't know what to compare that to, but. Like, a playoff team should never be down by 35 points, like, in the third quarter.
It was a relative must win.
Yeah, it's like we lost the Thrashers, you know, and I was upset. But, you know, at least we're not getting embarrassed. You know, like, it's embarrassing to lose a team, but it's even more embarrassing to lose, like, to be down by 35 on TNT. It was bad.
Yeah, like I went to the Clippers game. The Clippers played on a Saturday afternoon. And, you know, Clippers haven't exactly been there before, the fan base.
Yeah.
I was really impressed. It was a loud crowd. Everybody wore the red shirt, so they had like the red out or whatever. But the crowd got first half super loud. Third quarter lost a little energy because the Clips just went in the tank. Fourth quarter came back, stood for basically the last 5 minutes of the game. And at one point in the fourth quarter, the idiot, whoever does the musical prompts, you know, where they have to play the defense, that guy's like blaring the defense thing. And I think somebody told him, like, hey, moron, turn the thing off. The fans are loud. Like, I don't need your help, you idiot. And the fans were great. And so you just never know. Now with Atlanta, as you said, when you hit that point where you kind of could see the writing on the wall of the playoff series, And you get to that thing of maybe we shouldn't have a team, and you're saying stuff like that. Usually not a good playoff crowd.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go, and I'm going to be very – I'm probably going to be on the edge of the spectrum of fanboy, very loud, just because, I don't want us to lose 4-1. Like, I want us to win. I want miracles to take place. But I don't know if people around me are going to look at me like I'm crazy, or they're going to be, or if I can corral some people to get as loud as I am. But I guess I'll have something to write about on Wednesday.
Last thing, be prepared, because Boston fans travel. So you're going to have about 4,000 Boston fans there. And I personally, I mean, obviously I love the Boston fans go, but just going to the Clipper games where there's always fans of the other team, you know, like Bulls or Lakers, things like that. The fan, that can almost be discouraging in itself. Like, the other team will score, and it's like just as loud as when the home team scored, and you get the whole fan base goes in a funk. So watch out for that.
I will. I appreciate that.
It sounds like it's going to be a delightful night at the Phillips Arena.
I'm excited. I'm really excited.
All right, Rembert, we will check you out on Grantland all week. Enjoy the trip. Safe travels. Talk to you soon.
Bye, Bill. Thanks.
All right.
So I get to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.